You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Okay, so hi, Jamimi.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, you know, just another great day and getting ready to discuss Haiti with you, which I'm very excited about.
Yeah. Exciting and, you know, terrifying at the same time, but it's good to talk about Haiti.
Exciting, terrifying, confusing, all of the good stuff that you hope out of a good conversation.
Right.
So why don't I go ahead and introduce us? So I am Connor Eccles. I'm an associate editor here at Blogging Heads. And as our listeners know, I've been producing and sometimes hosting a series of conversations about how international actors view the world. And I'm thrilled to continue that project today with Dr. Jamimi Pierre, who is an associate professor at the Departments of Anthropology and African American Studies at UCLA, and also an activist with Black Alliance for Peace, where she works on issues related to Haiti. So thank you for joining me, Jamimi.
Thank you for having me. Yeah. And I have to say the Black Alliance for Peace is Haiti and the Americas, because we've expanded, just FYI. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Good things every day. glad to hear. And so, well, let's go ahead and get started. So Haiti has been in the news a lot over the last few weeks, with much of the coverage focusing on the fallout from President Jovenel Moise's, dramatic assassination in his home last month. And I definitely want to get into that in the conversation. And I also want to talk about the protest movement that we've seen over the past few years. But given that Haiti, I think, is a pretty significant blind spot for a lot of Americans, I think that it would be useful if we started with a bit of a wider view of Haitian history. So to start with what can only be called a difficult question, can you give our listeners a brief rundown of Haitian history?
Oh, wow. Okay.
however you want to do it. No.
I got to say Haiti is the second independent republic in the Western Hemisphere after the U.S., even though people don't want to talk about that much, but the only free independent nation, because the U.S. still had enslavement and brutal white supremacy during the Haitian Revolution. So Haiti was the first Black Republic in the Western Hemisphere in 1804, defeated the powerful army of Napoleon. Bonaparte Napoleon, the French army at the time, and this, you had these formerly enslaved people take control of the island and then declare a nation in full independence and declare itself a Black Republic. So Haiti has this history. A lot of people would say that's actually the reason why it's still paying for it, but that revolution really struck at the heart of global white supremacy at the time and really made these slave-owning nations and then the Europeans really afraid for what would happen if other Blacks revolted in the Western Hemisphere and elsewhere. So that's the beginning of Haiti's history, and it took a long time. The U.S. did not recognize Haiti until the 1860s, which is right around the time where the Civil War and the formal end of slavery. And then French did not recognize Haiti for a long time and forced Haiti to actually pay an indemnity. It would continue to challenge. And I have to say, in the War for Independence, Haiti was able to actually defeat also the British, the Spanish, and the American forces were helping out the French and so on. So this is an incredible revolution. And if you ever have a chance to visit Haiti and you go up to the Citadel, which is a wonder, one of the wonders of the world, you'll see, you know, the capturing of cannons from the British, from the Spanish, from the French, from this revolution. So that's important. And the other part that's important is that Haiti had to, you know, after a while, Haiti was completely isolated. This is a formerly enslaved population that's free in the middle of slavery, brutal slavery in the Western Hemisphere. It was completely isolated, and, you know, the elite, the bourgeois elite that emerges out of the Haitian government in the mid-1800s decided to basically, for some of us, sell their soul and agreed to pay France an indemnity, which was basically paying the white French slave owners for losing their property, their Black people. So basically, Haiti had to pay, Black people had to pay for their own independence. And it's the equivalent of, at this point, about, you know, 20-something, 30-something billion dollars. And Haiti paid that until 1947. there's a resurgence of research on this indemnity and which families benefited because they were still paying for it long into the 20th century. So that's an important thing. You know, this is a big theft, as people will say. If we think about, you know, the political and economic position of Haiti in there. So now the other part that's important to know about Haiti's history is the U.S. occupation of Haiti. So for the longest time, you know, U.S. had, once U.S. had recognized Haiti, had a lot of interest in keeping its having its interest in the Caribbean and basically pushing out the European powers that had so much power in the Western Hemisphere. The other thing I want to say quickly as an aside for people in the U.S. is that they have Haiti to thank for the Haitian Revolution for actually the Louisiana Purchase. And, you know, you learn history in the U.S. and you don't realize that the reason the French sold the Louisiana territory at such a cheap price because it lost its golden colony in the Western Hemisphere, and it's the loss of that crushed French hope of actually expanding in the Western Hemisphere, and it's basically Napoleon sold that territory to the U.S. I mean, it wasn't theirs to sell because Native Americans, sure. but they did sell that territory, which actually doubled the size of the U.S. So it's a direct result of the Haitian Revolution that you have these territories that become part of the U.S. So all along, the U.S. has been very much interested in Haiti. Late 1800s, what you have is Frederick Douglass was a representative sent to Haiti, U.S. representative in Haiti. And the U.S. has been trying to buy this little island at the top of Haiti, Mole Saint-Nicolas, since forever. In fact, that's where it wanted to establish a base. And Haitians completely continue to refuse, which is why it ended up taking Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So that's something to know for future reference as we talk about the contemporary moment. In 1915, the U.S. invaded and occupied Haiti for 14 years. And this is the longest occupation from 1914 to 1935. And part of that occupation was ostensibly to protect U.S. life and property. And what's interesting about the pretext for the occupation was the assassination of a Haitian president in 1915.
Interesting.
Yeah, so the parallels are really fascinating, which is why people are afraid that there's going to be another intervention. But the other part of that, in the years leading up to the U.S. Marines invading Haiti, you have the National City Bank of New York actually was becoming increasingly involved in Haiti's financial affairs. They pushed for Haiti's control of Haiti's railroads, ports, national banks, the sovereign debt. And it was the Citibank officials actually were already calling for U.S. military intervention, which is an important part of the history to know. Mm-hmm. And even Vice President Farnham wrote a memorandum outlining a strategy for occupation. And so by the time the U.S. actually came and occupied Haiti, the Citibank sent a request for U.S. Marines to move $500,000 of Haiti's gold to a reserve in a Wall Street vault. And this, you know, so this is really important to think about, you know, the business, the economic aspects of intervention. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. were there, and it was a brutal occupation. It was the first time, actually, the U.S. used aerial bombardment against the opposition to its occupation. It bombed villages and cities and killed thousands of Haitians and installed a forced labor called a forced labor regime to build roads and stuff in Haiti. And it was terrible. And they left by building a Haitian army, the gendarmerie, which would then be the bane of Haitian people's existence, a brutal mm-hmm. army, which then would be up, you know, brought up again, during the Duvalier dictatorship, which was a 29-year dictatorship, fully supported by the U.S. because Duvalier was, the anti-communist. And I have to link this to Cuba because it was in 1959 that the Duvalier dictatorship took place, the 1959 where you have the Cuban Revolution. Right. And the U.S. fully supported the Duvalier regime up until uprising pushed them out in 1986. And it was the U.S. and the French that flew them out in, you know, private jet to France, to exile in France. And then later on, you would have the, you know, the end of the Valley dictatorship. You have for the first time the rise of a popular movement against dictatorship. And it took a while. And then out of that, you have in 1989, 1990, the first free elections in Haiti. They have the rise of the Chambetron Alistide of the Lavalas family.
Dogs have featured in many Blogging Heads conversations.
Sorry. Of the Lavalas family. It was the first wide scale, you know, election that was the first time he had all the poor Haitians voting, and he won a landslide victory against the wishes of the U.S. And I have to say, because this is important, against the wishes of the U.S., because the U.S. Favorite puppet candidate, they were shocked. They lost, and Aristide, you know, the people power brought Aristide. And from the very beginning, then you had U.S. pressure against Aristide, which led after 9 months into a CIA backed, which is very well documented in the WikiLeaks papers and so on, a CIA backed coup d'etat against Aristide in 1991. Because of the protests and large numbers of Haitians coming to the U.S., Bill Clinton was forced to reinstate Aristide, but then that led a long occupation. He reinstated Aristide with 20,000 U.S. Marines, which stayed in Haiti until 1999. So Aristide was brought back in 1994, 1999. And then the biggest occupation, which I argue is a continual occupation, happens in 2004 when U.S. Special Forces landed in Haiti, put Aristide on a plane and flew him to Africa. and then the UN actually sanctioned this because the U.S. multinational, U.S., France, and Canada led coup d'etat. And then after that, you have a multinational force. They flew out Aristide within the same day. You had thousands of Canadian, French, and U.S. troops there, and which was then buttressed by the UN, by UN's peacekeeping, so-called peacekeeping, because it wasn't peacekeeping for Haitians, from June 1st, 2004. And this, to me, is a legacy we're still living now. The majority of the military of the UN has left, but there's a UN integrated office that makes all the decisions in Haiti right now. And so we call that an ongoing occupation. So I hope that's a long enough, I mean, that's a short enough history.
That is a very good summary of the history. And I think if there's one thing that I could identify as the clearest through line there, it's that there has just been absolutely constant foreign intervention, particularly U.S. intervention in Haiti.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And so that's something that's interesting. And I think it's not something, I mean, part of why I mentioned that Americans don't seem to know as much about Haiti and why I think that's particularly interesting is that I think there are few countries in which the U.S. has had more influence than they've had in Haiti. Like, the U.S. and Haitian history are deeply, deeply connected.
Yes, very much connected. And people don't want to believe that. It's fascinating. It's so intertwined. They have so much say so for example, people can look up the Ottawa Initiative. This is in the fall of 2003, where U.S. representatives, Canadian representatives, and French representatives met at this resort and decided that Aristide, the popular elected president of Haiti, had to go. Right, and they decided that in a few months later you have a coup d'état, and this coup d'état happens because the U.S. comes in and sends the special forces, put Aristide on a plane, and flies them out. And even when people in the hemisphere, Jamaica offered Aristide asylum, Venezuela offered Aristide asylum, they threatened them with sanctions and all kinds of things. And they said, and the WikiLeaks papers reveal this, they said that they did not want his presence in the Western Hemisphere because they were afraid of what his president meant, because he was so popular. And so, but the U.S. has, you know, but I think the 2004 occupation and ongoing occupation, the coup d'etat occupation, is really a key moment for us, because this is the way you've been able to have the U.S. intervene, and it's not necessarily as a direct occupation as the 1915, which was brutal. And this one is that you basically destroyed the Haitian state. You take over through, you know, the comfort of bourgeoisie, as we would call them, through, it's almost like indirect rule, right? So you cook up elections. So the last elections, Moïse is part of this party, where his predecessor was handpicked and chosen and put in place by the U.S. And so this is an ongoing intertwined relationship that's economic, that's political, that's also cultural that we have to reckon with.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good opportunity for us to get into the story, the start of the story of how Moise comes to power. And that's one that the U.S. is deeply involved with as well. And my understanding of it starts with basically the earthquake, right? So you have the earthquake in 2010 that ends up killing, I believe, hundreds of thousands of Haitians. Americans are familiar with that probably in a somewhat distant way, but it was an event that registered very strongly here, even, you know, when events like that tend not to, for the American audience. And what's really interesting about it is what happened in the aftermath as well, because you start to see so much of what happened and this real transformation of Haitian politics almost towards this American, I don't know if control is a fair word, but under even more American influence. So can you give some of the story of what happened following 2010?
Yes. And so, you have the earthquake January 12, 2010. The other thing I wanted to say, so the peacekeeping operation, the UN peacekeeping operation, the UN is not a friend to Haiti, according to Haitians, because it's been brutal. A lot of sexual violence, a lot of, you know, children being assaulted. But what the UN did in September was bring cholera to Haiti. Mm-hmm. And it brought cholera by dumping sewage, you know, it's sewage from one of its bases into one of the main rivers that provides a water source for these villages in the middle of the country, which is disgusting, right? I mean, the idea that you're pumping sewage in people's, the water that people drink and wash and bathe in, right? And that killed anywhere between 10 and 50,000 people. And we'll never know because it was in the villages. And a lot of times, by the time people could make it to the clinic and hospital, they were dead because cholera is a deadly disease. So you have the UN there and you have the, you know, cholera. So in September, in October, cholera is decimating Haiti. But the U.S. is insisting on not postponing the election because they did not like the person in charge, who was President Préval. They thought he was too close to Aristide, even though he had completely denounced Aristide. But they thought he wasn't a good enough. They were mad at him because he agreed to do the Petrocaribe. He agreed to Venezuela's Petrocaribe project for the Caribbean for cheap oil for development, right? So that's we can talk about that later.
Sure, we'll come back to that.
So then the U.S. pays $38 million for these elections that they insist on. And so the Organization of American States is very much involved in this, right? And we can talk about that as well. So they come in and they're supposed to be running these elections. And what happens is the first round goes and the hand-picked person did not make the first round, which was Michel Martelly, who... It was not really a U.S. was that a Haitian citizen? And so part of the thing is one of the discussions with Martelly was a guy who was a former, you know, a music star in Haiti, a Duvalierist, right? He was he supported Duvalier. He was living in Miami. His house was in foreclosure. He was, you know, having all kinds of financial situations. And people were saying he did not even have a Haitian passport. But they found him. And then days before the elections, he, you know, passports show up that he's a Haitian citizen. So there's that. But they handpicked him, right? And so then he comes in and he loses the first round. So he loses the first round of the elections.
Right. And that first round also had, so he ends up, he comes in third, right?
Which he comes in third.
And that led, that election had something like 25% turnout, I want to say. It was really...
Very, very low. And all the runoff candidates received less than the 11% of the votes combined, right? So it was such a low voter turnout, irregularities, and so on. And so, the U.S. basically said that the results were fraudulent when their favorite candidate did not make it and the candidate that they did not want, which was Préval's political party in sight. His name is, Claude Célestin, if I remember that correctly.
Jude Célestin, right?
Jude Célestin. Thank you for telling me. So then Hillary Clinton leaves the Middle East. This is at the moment of the so-called Arab Spring, right? This is like the spring of 2011, the early 2011, flies to Haiti and basically threatens threatens Préval, which was the president, with exile, threatening the freezing of U.S. visas for elected officials, withholding disaster aid if they don't allow Michel Martelly to become the second person.
Yeah, and that might sound conspiratorial, but I'll make sure to include a link that this, we really do have a lot of information about this, that the U.S. put some unbelievable pressure.
Not just pressure, it's like, it's gangsterism. Like, just like, think about this, like, you know, you fly to another country and people have written about this, there are books about this. In fact, my very first article for the Black Agenda Report was about this, like the fact that, you know, the Obama administration sent, and this is Obama's legacy, and I have to say in Haiti, is this the installation of the PHTK, which is the Tet Kale party of which Martelly was part. And so they brought in these runoff elections, and of course, the other thing about these elections, they did not allow Famille Lavalas, which was the biggest political party at the time.
Aristide's
party. They did not allow them to run. Right, so you have the majority of the people's party not participating. So Martelly comes into power with the message, you know, of like Haiti is open for business, which was perfect for what, you know, the U.S. wanted in terms of neoliberal policies, opening up the country to foreign corporations and so on and so forth. So this is how Martelly comes into power under the full support and the forcing of his, you know, of his position onto the Haitian people. And so then Martelly runs, and under him, there's lots of corruption, but it opens up Haiti to all kinds of fleecing. And this is at the time where, you know, it's released that Haiti has tons of minerals, billions of dollars of untapped resources, including oil, so on and so forth. And so then, you know, the fight is on who's going to get these contracts for mining, for oil, and so on. And he opens up the country. And it's under him that you have this broad-scale corruption. But by the end of his rule, you know, he was also ruling by decree, refusing to hold elections. It was, you know, and then he handpicks Jovenel Moïse, to continue his legacy, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and even Moïse's presidential election was no one wanted, right? So people were protesting their irregularities and against the Organization of American States, which ran these elections, really caused all kinds of fraudulent, you know, there's all kinds of corruption. And so Moïse gets into power against the will of the majority of the people with even lower turnout than Martelly. And that's how he comes into power.
Yeah. And Moïse basically follows a lot of one of the other interesting things is Moïse comes from basically being this completely unknown figure. And suddenly he comes in and he's the next president of Haiti after basically no one knowing who he is, right?
Exactly. So no one knew who he was, except that he was handpicked by Martelly, and people say he was like a banana, a farmer, and so on. But people didn't really know. And I mean, the same way that, you know, Martelly's campaign was bankrolled by a lot of people in the U.S., by some of the oligarchy, Moïse's was also bankrolled. But Moïse coming in means that it allowed them to continue stealing money. And so part of the thing is they stole, that political party stole more than $2 billion of that Petrocaribe funds that Venezuela had, you know, agreed with Haiti and a lot of Caribbean countries. I mean, and I have to explain, should I explain the Petrocaribe funds? Yeah. So what happens is Petrocaribe was this, you know, under Hugo Chavez, that was his policy, you know, one of his good neighbor policies towards Caribbean countries. And this is when oil prices were high and Venezuela had a lot of oil. Mm-hmm. And so Hugo Chavez, you know, reached out to these Caribbean countries and said, look, the way we can help you is we can provide you oil very cheaply, right? We'll provide you with oil on a 25-year loan where you don't have to pay anything. It's a 1% interest. And so you can sell the oil and use the revenue from the oil for development projects, right? As you can tell, as you imagine, this was completely dangerous for U.S. corporations. And they really were upset at Pleval for signing. You know, they tried to bully him, and he said no, and he finally signed it in 2007. They pressured other Caribbean countries to not participate because this would mean, you know, the oil companies would be losing out. So this was Petrocaribe. And so the money that the Haitian government was saving for development projects was completely siphoned off by this party, the Michel Martelly party, the oligarchs, who got all the contracts, you know, the development contract. We need to talk about the oligarchs making out like bandits after the earthquake. Mm-hmm. But then when there's a report that came out in late 2018 about the scale of corruption of this political party, and Moïse was implicated in that because that's how, you know, that's what bankrolled his candidacy and president, his run for president, then there were tons of protests, you know, in Haiti, hundreds of thousands of people in the street. Where is the Petrocaribe money? What's going on? And so there are continuous protests from 2018 all through 2019, 2020, and then especially the protests when Moïse, you know, the biggest protests against Moïse were in 2021 in February, in March, when Moïse's term, according to the Constitution and the Haitian Bar Federation, his term was supposed to end February 7, 2021, and he refused to step down. And so then the protests, you know, he was not a popular president. So then the protests just got even more insistent. And this is where you see the who controls Haiti, because they're, you know, the first statement Joe Biden made about Haiti was that Jovenel Moïse would carry out his term until 2022. Right. So you have that, and then you have the Organization of American States saying the same thing, and then the core group, which I have to tell people, you know, that comes out of, which is why we say Haiti's under occupation. The core group is a convening of members of Canada, France. It's a group made up of and representatives from Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the U.S., the European Union, the Organization of American States, that basically determine what goes on in Haiti. So whenever the core group releases a statement, they, you know, this is the law. So it's a group of people, of non-Haitians and white people that actually run Haiti. So the core group also affirmed Moïse's position. And so they're the ones that kept them in power.
Right. And I want to come back to the protests and Moïse and kind of getting up to his assassination as well. But this is a related question, but I just wanted to pause and ask just how do the Haitian people view the international community and view the U.S.? Is it overwhelmingly negative? Are there people that, you know, I'm sure that there's some contingent that benefits from that. Kind of like that benefits from U.S. interference? I guess what's the ideological landscape?
The ideological landscape is as complex. You know, it's complex and it's not, right? So the majority of the people think the U.S. is an imperial power. They don't like the core group. So, for example, during the protests against Moïse in the late 2019, there are all these messages. Like, if you look at the media, it's, you know, the message was like, no more foreign military occupation, no more foreign meddling. They call the core group criminals. They said, you know, they call them the core gang. They say those are the real gangs running Haiti. And so, you know, they call MINUSCA, which was the acronym of the UN Peacekeeping Corps. You know, there are all these signs, even if you go around Haiti, MINUSCA equals cholera, right? And so part of that is people know, Haitian people know, and even now after the assassination, the main message that's coming across the political spectrum in Haiti is no intervention. They don't want troops. They're tired of these foreigners. And, you know, Haiti has been under occupation since 2004. Things have not gotten better, right? You know, the reality is you have spent billions of dollars for a UN occupation, and you still don't have roads, and you still don't have electricity. You have, you know, you've done this. And so part of that is people know that the U.S. is meddling. And I have to say, though, what's happened, and I don't know if we want to come up to the present after the assassination, but one of the things that you know, so you have that. You have the majority of people know that the U.S. is meddling and so on. You also have, you know, a lot of this would not happen without two other groups, which are the oligarchy, which are the non-black oligarchy in Haiti, which is which is an interesting group of people, of, you know, Libyans, Italians, French, these 10 to 12 families who own the ports. which is why you have all these guns running around the country, you know, so you have all this stuff happening, and who benefit from major contracts, you know, that are given to them and so on. But you also have the Compadre bourgeoisie, who I call self-hating, because, you know, that you, it's like, you know, if you think about African societies, you need these to actually, you know, do the bidding of the imperial countries, you know, in Haiti. So you have the few hand people that are of use at some point until they get thrown out away, like Moïse was thrown away and so right. on. And so, yeah, so part of that is, so you have the latest government that was installed by the U.S. and the core group asking for U.S. security help when most of the Haitian people were saying, no, we don't want that. And so that, so we do have a.
And what was interesting too was that for once, and I'm not exactly sure what this means in the greater historical context, but the U.S. actually said no.
They said no, but yeah, they said no publicly. At the same time, you know, they sent a high power delegation that same weekend to convince the guy Claude Joseph, who declared that he was prime minister, you know, running the country. They convinced him to step down and put in Ariel Henry. As prime minister, this is the high-powered Biden delegation. And then Biden released a statement that said that they would help Haiti with security to deal with the gangs and then to deal with the elections. And so there, you know, this is setting up. And then you have Ariel Henry just as recently as yesterday asking for that kind of intervention. So it's making it seem like they're not interested, but at the same time, they're setting up this space to say, well, the Haitians called us and asked us for help.
Interesting. It is very interesting. And I think it is helpful to see. So in your view, basically most of the masses of Haiti hold a negative view of outside interference and want to kind of push it out. But then you've got this, I guess, landed elite, that is holding a lot of the power that wants the U.S. to continue interfering significantly in Haitian politics because it benefits them personally.
Yes. Well, right. But within the, though, you have two groups. You have the commercial elite, the oligarchy, which is non-black, right? And we have to, because Haiti's 99% black. And so, but you have an oligarchy of like Levantine and white people running all the businesses, having all the contracts, you know, the international contracts. And a lot of them are like transnational elites. So like the BGOs who's rich all over the Caribbean, right? And these people have like U.S. visas and or U.S. You know, residence and citizenship, and so they live in Florida and stuff like that, right? So you have them, but then you have that, you know, that political class, you know, that's willing to sell, you know, its loyalty to the highest bidder. And so you do, you know, so you do have like this, that's the Compradore bourgeoisie who's sitting there allowing themselves to be used in the imperial machinations. And so you have that, the elite, the political opposition. There's also the bourgeois opposition, which, you know, is also fighting each other. But all those together are small group compared to the large masses. And what's telling is during Jovenel Moïse's funeral in northern Haiti, how the U.S. delegation had to be rushed out of there because people were so angry with them, because they're like, nothing happens in Haiti without the knowledge and support of the U.S. government, right? So everybody thinks that the U.S. is part of this. And they think they're, you know, either they knew about it and allowed it to happen, or they had a clear role in this assassination.
Right. And so maybe that's a good transition into, I guess, just talking through what we know about what happened with the assassination. And we don't seem to know that much, but I think I'm sure that you have an idea of at least the different narratives. And so maybe first to start with, what do you think? What have you been able to gather about what happened? And then maybe after that, we can talk a little bit about the official narrative and how that might differ.
Right. Well, I think this was a fight among the elite. I think that there was a way that the party itself, the PTHK party, Moise, you know, fell out of favor with some of the oligarchy. And, you know, people are saying that, you know, for example, he had threatened to seize property of like Reginald Bulos, one of these oligarchy. And also I he wasn't doing what he was supposed to do. And I think that, you know, he started towards the end of his life, he was talking about stopping people's contracts, you know, these people who were making all this money off of contracts. And so I think this was, and also I think because he was not popular, and I think he was becoming a liability for the so-called international community, which is, of course, you know, who it's the U.S., the U.N., and the core group. And so it's a combination of things. I think so the party itself, I think, you know, fractured and didn't want him in. But I also think it served the purposes of the international community to get rid of him. I do think there's no way any of this could have happened if it wasn't bankrolled by some very wealthy people. So, right. So that's what's not coming out of the
investigation. Yeah, so what was the story early on? Everyone was talking about this kind of mystery doctor from Florida. That seemed a little suspicious.
Yeah, and I think he probably felt like he could be president. He was probably unwitting. I do think he didn't have any money, though. He was a broke doctor, minister living in Florida, that they probably thought, you know, he thought that if once they got rid of Moise, they would install him, because that's what the U.S. has done, you know, just bring in somebody from the U.S. and right. install them as prime minister, like they did with Aristide. They brought in Yuri Latour, you know, they brought in this guy, Gerald Latour, too, and installed him, you know, from Florida. He hadn't lived in Haiti for like 40 years. So he thought, but I do think I wonder if we'll ever find out who the mastermind is or who paid for this, because that's where we'll know the reason, the full reason. Yeah. I mean, we're all speculating, but what everybody knows is that this was a master. There are masterminds behind this that were able to pay 20 something Colombians, you know, $3,000-$4,000 each a month to case out and be in Haiti. What's coming out now, though, is that, and then the Colombian press has been on this, is that apparently 5 to 7, which makes sense if you think about assassinations, because, you know, you don't need 26 people for an assassination, right? So, you know, they're saying, like, these Colombians thought they were arresting him, like, doing a citizen's arrest, but they're saying, like, 5 to 6 of them knew what was going on, and those are the ones that are still missing. They extracted them out of there, you know, immediately. So we don't know where it's going. What I do think is problematic is the fact that Moise's wife has given more interviews to the foreign press than she has to the police. Right? So she's everywhere, right? Which to me is suspicious to a lot of Haitians, right? But the thing is that you have the FBI coming in and leaving with all this evidence. You have the Haitian police chief, which people don't like, because he's, you know, he comes from like the post-Aristide. I mean, you know, he was a very brutal police chief, and people were very upset that he was actually made police chief in the fall of 2020. People don't trust him because they're saying, you know, how is it that this guy had like 21 security people around him on the night of his death, and none of them were killed, none of them were hurt, right? And so people are still wondering, how did this assassination happen where none of his security team were involved or hurt? And so there's a lot of speculation, but I do think this was an internal thing. I do think there's some very wealthy people that bankrolled it. And I don't think we'll ever, unless we catch the bankrolling, you know, there are going to be a lot of scapegoats, and I don't think we'll ever know the truth.
And is there a clean, so I guess this is a two-part question. Is there a clear official narrative about what happened, and do Haitians on the ground believe that narrative?
Well, Haitian on the ground, I don't think believe any of these narratives. And so, you know, so part of that is, you know, I get all these, you know, if you watch enough Haitian political news, it's just a discussion. It's like the focus is on who funded this operation. Right. A lot of people think that the Colombians, you know, which was they believe that the Colombians, there are some Colombians or all the Colombians were part of it. But the thing is, who led the Colombians to come to Haiti and kill the president, right? And so and so the official narrative is like these Colombians, you know, came in, they were funded by some groups that this hapless minister was, you know, was in meetings and behind it. And then some of Moise's, so they're saying some of his Moise's political opponents, like these judges that he fired back in February, I forgot her name, this woman, that there's a warrant for arrest that he fired. Right. They're saying that they're the ones that bankrolled it. And people don't believe that. And they're thinking they're using scapegoats to hide the money behind the assassination. Mm-hmm. And people don't put it past the FBI either, especially since a lot of these killers were, it's being revealed that they were like DEA, they were witnesses they were trained by some, informants for the DEA. And so people are like, the U.S. is all up in this. So that's the other thing I think that's coming out.
Yeah. And I think, and it's interesting because that's another thing. And there's no solid evidence that the U.S. had anything to do with the coup. But what I think people miss is a lot of the thinking that might sound conspiratorial from our perspective does make sense when you look at, and I hope we've demonstrated with the longer sweep of Haitian history, the scale of intervention is really kind of hard to get your mind around. And the fact that we've got these rumors going around about, potential U.S. involvement is really not surprising given that context.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, if I told you that Hillary Clinton flew in and got in a room and threatened the sitting president of a sovereign nation with exile if they didn't allow their own candidate to be in the runoff of an election, people would not believe me if it wasn't for the WikiLeaks files that explicitly states these things. I mean, WikiLeaks files also demonstrate, for example, some of the key reporters are in cahoots with the U.S., right? Private emails of like one of the reporters from the Miami Herald. She's emailing, Hillary Clinton's advisor about, what's going to happen and sending them inside data. So the scale of corruption, if it wasn't for like the release of these diplomatic and secret cables, we know they're happening, but the cables actually demonstrate that for us. And one of the, and I have to promote this, Kim Ives, of IET Liberté and Ansel Hertz did a whole series on WikiLeaks in Haiti, showing the depth of intervention and influence in Haiti, that where they show the cables, they read through the cables and they tell you all of that. So if people want to do that, they might want to check out the WikiLeaks in Haiti series out of The Nation.
Yeah, definitely. And I'll link to that on the bloggingheads.tv website version of this conversation. And another thing I think is interesting, I was just prepping for this interview and actually just recently saw this, was that among the other notable things, and just to demonstrate the level of importance that the Haitian elite give to the U.S., is that a lot of them scrambled after the assassination to hire lobbyists in D.C. And I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, that should tell you everything, right? And so including Reginald Bulos, who a lot of people are blaming for bankrolling this, that they were scrambling even before the assassination, paying thousands of dollars to lobbyists to talk to Washington. So what does that tell you? That where did they see the seat of – what other sovereign nation goes to another nation to lobby that nation's government so that they can have a role in Haiti? So that tells you where the seat of power in Haiti is not in Haiti. Haiti's a colony, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And yeah, I mean, I think that's another thing where I just kind of want to hammer it home, because it's just, it is surprising to a lot of people, the extent. And I remember there was some Jonathan Katz wrote a thing about this recently in a Substack letter after he had written something about just, he wanted to provide this historical narrative about Haiti, and it was a piece that was commissioned by a major paper that ended up getting rejected, and then he published somewhere else, in part because the history, it really does sound a little crazy. It does, but so much of it is true, and it's very important to get out there.
Definitely.
Yeah, and so a couple more topics before we close. I'd say just two key things. The first is, there have been a lot of calls for elections. And in theory, elections are supposed to be held, I guess, later this year. And as you noted, the Rush 2010 elections were unpopular and helped lead to a lot of the problems that we've seen today. So do you think that it's a good idea for there to be elections in the near future, or are there, credible figures that could help the transition back to democratic governance?
Okay. So before I answer that, I forgot to say that. So there's a whole group. There's a Haitian civil society group that's been meeting since the assassination to say we want a Haitian solution to our Haitian problem that the U.S. government and the OAS and the courtroom completely bypassed. In fact, July 17th, they were having their huge conference, and they're a mixed bag of different people, communities, but political elites, that's saying we don't want outsiders to decide who our next president or next prime minister is going to be. On the day that they're meeting, the core group releases that Ariel Henry would be the new prime minister and is called out his government and lists his cabinet in on the Tuesday after. So that already tells you, and then these, the group is completely silenced. And so they're, they're protesting Twitter, whatever, and they're saying they basically undercut them, right? And one of the key reasons why Moïse was so unpopular was that he was trying to force elections to change the constitution so that he would give the executive more power. And then Haiti's constitution has it that a president cannot run more than once. Like, you cannot, there's only one term. You can run again, but you have to wait for at least another term to go by before you run again. And this is to stop, the history of dictatorships, right? So,
So
he was trying to change the constitution, trying to open up, the thing for foreign access to different things. Quick aside, during the 1915 occupation, the U.S., FDR rewrote Haiti's constitution.
What year would this have been?
1915.
So Wilson, maybe.
Was it Wilson? No, not the president. He was not president at the time.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah, so I have to look this up, but he rewrote Haiti's constitution. He says, I'm proud of it. It's a good constitution. And the reason why that's important is because after slavery, after the revolution, the Haitian constitution specifically said no foreigners could own land in Haiti, right? So in rewriting the constitution, it removed that clause from the Haitian constitution, right? That allowed foreigners to own things and remove the people, the peasants, from their land. So one of the things that Martelly and Moïse were doing was giving swaths of land, and most recent to one of the rich families, a pay, 25,000 acres, I think, a lot of acres will remove the farmers so that Coca-Cola can go in a deal with them to grow stevia, right? The sweetener, right? So there's that. So anyways, the people were really upset that he was trying to change the constitution. And they said we could not have elections under an undemocratic regime, right? Moïse was ruling by decree. There was no parliament. There was no, the election commission he appointed everyone. And so people are saying, we're not having elections until we figure out a democratic way out of this. And whatever Moïse was putting in place is not democratic. There's no legal or political basis for it. So when the U.S. and the U.N. established this new, which is what they did, against the voices, leaving out the voices of the majority of the political elite in Haiti, the political groups of Haiti fighting for Haitian solutions, Ariel Henry, who also was brought in after Aristide as the council of Haitians that helped the foreigners run in Haiti, his cabinet is actually the same political party, except for one or two people. And the people are saying there's no change. It's like PTHK without Moïse. And people are saying it is still an undemocratic formation. And so there cannot be elections when you have a prime minister that wasn't elected, when you have a government that wasn't elected, and it's the same people from the Moïse's people. Now, for the U.S., they want to have an election to show the veneer that, once they have the election, they can, not deal with Haiti. Haiti's quote unquote stabilized, right? Mm-hmm. So it makes them look good to what I have to push for these elections. But I think when we might have more military intervention might be when people protest the forcing of elections onto the people. People want their own solutions, and they don't want the solutions to begin with backroom deals with the U.S. and a group of comprador bourgeoisie.
Right. And so your view is that there is no way to have a legitimate election given the current makeup of the government.
There's not a legitimate government.
Right. And that's the view of of most.
That's
Haitians.
A view of the opposition, that the political opposition, most of the people. In fact, you know, back in 2000, back in February, when Moïse refused to step down, you know, the opposition actually had put out a whole new document with the whole, say, okay, we're going to have an interim government. You know, they picked a leader who was a judge, a sitting judge at the time. And what Moïse did, he fired the judge and all the judges. And so the local political opposition have a plan. They have a plan to bring back legitimacy that's been completely shut out and bypassed by the international community. And so no one's going to want these, and they're going to see these elections as illegitimate as Martelly's and Moïse's.
And so given all of that, I guess to close out, I would just ask you maybe just to speculate a little bit on what you think is going to happen over at least these next few months. So we've got this real acute political crisis. We've got a contested government. We've got a recently assassinated president. We've got obviously constantly changing things. There's a lot of talk of, I understand there to be significant kind of paramilitary organizations. So in that kind of confusing canvas, I guess, what do you see happening over the next few months? And do you see a resolution to this crisis in the near future?
I don't see a resolution if the international community is still involved, to be honest. I think people know this. And if the international community, and by this I mean, because it's not the entire international community, I mean the U.S. and the OAS and the U.N., which are, you know, all working in lockstep, walking in lockstep. I think, you know, what's going to be used is the gang situation as pretext for for a military presence. You know, part of the things is there are these gangs that are emerging and calling themselves revolutionary. I do think what's happened is Moïse has become some kind of a martyr in Haiti, where he wasn't liked before, but people, even people who didn't like him, were just disgusted at the fact that they sent foreigners to massacre this man, and the way that they killed him was just terrible. And so even people who did not like him are just completely disgusted by it. And so I think unless the international community steps back and pretends to allow the opposition to come up with its own solution, whatever solution that the international community backs is going to backfire. If it's not now, it's going to be later. I do think the armed groups that are there, there's an awakening that's happening that's really interesting, in that they're saying that their problem is the oligarchy and the foreigners. And they're blaming the oligarchy and the foreigners for the death of Moïse, and he's become a martyr for a lot of them. And so that remains to be seen. I do think we are going to see a military footprint, more military interventions in the next few months as a pretext to force elections. And I think they are going to force elections, and they might convince some of the opposition to join in to give veneer of legitimacy. But I think the political crisis is going to go on for a while. But then again, my hope is, you know, we thought slavery was going to go on for a long time, and then you had the Haitian Revolution. So the only hope is that with Haiti, you never know. You never know when the people are just going to be like, it's enough, and something happens and it destroys the current system.
Well, there's no better place to end than on a hopeful note, even if it was preceded by a lot of less than hopeful analysis.
Right.
So we'll go ahead and end there. But I want to thank you again so much, Jemima, for joining me. And I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course.